This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Cherry Jones, is nominated for an Emmy for her guest appearance on the HBO series Succession. She's already won 2 Emmys for her performance on 24 as President Allison Taylor and her performance on A Handmaid's Tale as Offred's mother. In the Amazon series Transparent, she played a celebrated lesbian poet and professor, and in Apple TV's recent series Defending Jacob, she played a defense attorney. For many years, she was best known as a theater actor. She got her first Tony Award for her performance in the 1995 Broadway revival of The Heiress, and her second for her performance in the 2005 original production of Doubt. Jones appeared in The Glass Menagerie, Moon for the Misbegotten, Angels in America, and many other plays. Her current Emmy nomination is one of 18 nominations for Succession. The series is about a rich family who owns and runs a global media empire. The head of the family, Logan Roy, is a ruthless tyrant who manipulates and emotionally abuses his 4 grown children as they each compete to win his favor and be named his successor. The family's media empire is being threatened by a hostile takeover, and to fight it off, Logan is trying to acquire a media rival called PGM. Cherry Jones plays Nan Pierce, who runs PGM, which is owned by her family. Her family and her media company contrast with Logan Roy's. She's from old money, very stately, and her media company is known for its progressive politics. The Roy family is more crude. They're all about power and money, and their flagship news operation is comparable to Fox News. In this scene, Nan Pierce has invited the Roy family to her estate to discuss the deal. She's accepted the price the Roy family is willing to pay for her company, but she has other terms she insists they agree to before she's willing to sell. Logan Roy is played by Brian Cox. Here's Cherry Jones as Nan Pierce.
Very well. If we can clear up our ethical concerns, I think we can talk. We would like to retain some board seats and get ironclad editorial protections in place.
I think that could be hammered out.
Also, I think we would also like to have a conversation about management.
Uh-huh.
I won't have that man overseeing our news, I'm sorry. It's just not tenable.
That won't be a problem.
More important, we would like you to publicly announce a successor.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like the person you publicly announce to be Siobhan Roy.
Well, that's not quite how I do things.
Well, it will have to be, or there's no deal. We want to announce the sale and Shiv at the same time because, frankly, she may be one of you, but she's young, she's a woman, and her politics fit better with the core values of our family business. So, that's the offer.
Well, to be fair, you don't have an offer. I have an offer. And if I announce my daughter will be announced on my time.
Okay. Let me explain something.
Oh, please.
You can't put a value on what we do.
Funny, I have put a value on what you do.
Well, if you won't budge, then I'm afraid we have no deal.
Then we're done.
Cherry Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. Welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your Emmy nomination.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Terry.
So, you are so great. I love that you can so convincingly play like an old money, very entitled woman. So, did you have people to draw on for your character in Succession? Were there people who were like old money, entitled with an estate that you could draw on for, you know, the style of speaking and the body language? Because her body language conveys, like, I've always had privilege. I've never known anything but that.
It was interesting because I know that I played her maybe as a woman who no longer completely exists. Those gals are leaving us. But I wanted her to be that sort of last stand of that old guard of old, old blue blood WASP money, where they go to the camps in the summer and sleep under horse blankets and then come back to their mansions or their Ivy League schools in the fall. And I, because I'm in the theater and I'm in the not-for-profit theater, had been for many years, of course, at these board dinners, and I have met many of these women. So it was delicious to get to tap in to all those different women that I've met and either enjoyed or been slightly appalled by.
You have to play the contradiction in her life in that she runs a progressive, you know, media group. But in her own life, you know, she lives in an estate that's kind of a bubble. And she has a cook who's, you know, preparing this dinner for a whole lot of people where the Roy family and her family get together to discuss this takeover or merger. And so she says to the cook who's like serving hors d'oeuvres, like, "You never take time out for yourself. You should have a drink with us." And of course, like, the woman who's overseeing all this big dinner can't do that.
Yes, when I came to that line, I thought, well, there goes any sense of nobility about this woman. You know, it was that was probably the most telling line for me as an actress about this character. For an actor, it's always so much more interesting to have a character who, on one hand, seems to be trying to do everything with a sense of responsibility for society, and then you see her patronize this woman who works for her, who is doing 50 things at once to put together this magnificent meal for all these fabulously wealthy people. And it's just so cringeworthy in an instant understanding who this woman is. And it really did make me cringe when I read it on the page.
My understanding is that Frank Rich recommended you for the role. Now, Frank Rich used to be the New York Times theater critic and was, during those years, probably the most powerful theater critic in America. And you were performing mostly on stage back then. And he's since gone on to work on TV shows, including Veep and, of course, Succession. So when you first met him, were you still thinking of him as like the theater critic who could make or break a show?
The first time I actually got to meet Frank Rich was I had gone to San Francisco to do an interview on City Arts and Lectures, Sidney Goldstein's City Arts and Lectures. And the night I arrived, Frank was being interviewed. And afterwards, we were all introduced, and I was 50 years old at that point, but I was like a schoolgirl, you know, to be with Frank Rich. We lived in fear and terror of Frank Rich in the theater. And of course, he was absolutely delightful. So I'd gotten to know him a little bit. Holly Hunter and J. Smith Cameron and I all have come up together, and Jay plays Jerry on Succession, the counsel to Logan Roy. And Holly Hunter plays a wretched character who is stabbing me in the back. And at one point, we walked past Frank's director chair, and there it was in black and white, Frank Rich. And we both sort of shuddered just to see it in black and white again, his name.
So I want to talk with you about Transparent. You play Leslie Mackinaw, a famous poet and professor who has become a lesbian icon. And Gabby Hoffman plays Allie Pfefferman, who is the daughter of a transgender woman named Maura, who only recently came out as trans. So Allie is starting graduate school and has been taken under your wing because you're her professor. And you've both also recently attended a women's festival called Idlewild. And Allie brought along her parent, Maura, unaware that trans women were not welcome at this women's festival. This is also where your character and Allie first sleep together. So this scene takes place a little later at your office, and Gabby Hoffman as Allie speaks first.
Yeah, so it's official. I'm no longer a career undergrad. Diploma's in the mail.
Well, that is tremendous. That's great, Sprout. I'm proud of you.
Thank you. It's kind of weird. Big change. Plus, I'm still recovering from Idlewild. Is that normal?
Well, you know, it kind of depends on the year. Sometimes the Idlewild hangover can take a few days, and sometimes it can take a few weeks, and then my Red Bull budget man just goes right through the roof. Is Mara okay?
I don't know. I think she will be, but...
Yeah?
Yeah. I guess, wish I'd known, you know, about the divisiveness in that whole community.
Yeah, well, I would have told you if you told me that you were bringing her.
Yeah. But it actually kind of relates to what I've been thinking about, you know, this whole pain and anxiety that's just been passed down through the generations, and not just the Holocaust or the pogroms or the Jushus. It's just sort of more like metaphorical Holocausts.
Or... Allie, you don't have to perform for me.
I'm not. I didn't know that I was.
Just be yourself.
Okay.
I want you to be one of my TAs next year.
Oh my God, really? Thank you. That's great. That's great.
But let me just toss an idea at you.
Okay.
You and I, we really had some fun at the fest. Did we not?
Uh-huh. Yes, we did. I didn't know if we were going to bring that up.
It's up.
Okay.
Honestly, you're someone that I would really like to take my time with. I would really like to take my time getting to know. But it's against the faculty code of conduct for professors to students.
Even their grad students.
Even grad students. So, take your pick. You want to be my student? Or you want to be my old lady?
So, Cherry Jones, this character, I think, is supposed to be modeled on Eileen Miles, who is a poet and professor, and who at this point in the life of Jill Soloway, the showrunner for Transparent, they were having a relationship at this point. So did you think of your character as being modeled on Eileen Miles, who also has some scenes in Transparent, so I imagine you met her?
I certainly did think of myself as being modeled on Eileen, because it's very clear to me, made clear to me by Jill, that's basically who I was playing. And of course, I couldn't get close to playing Eileen, because she is such an original. And I had to really butch up, because I always thought, you know, I was always such a tomboy and sort of big boned, and I never thought of myself as butch, but I thought, oh, it'll be easy to do that. But I learned very quickly that it was one of the more difficult roles I'd ever had, because as I attempted it, I and my seduction of Gabby Hoffman's character, I would often just blush so much that I would have to. It was very funny to play, because I haven't played a lot of. I've played a lot of single women and women who are not married. And so I haven't played a lot of love scenes in my life. So to find myself at 60 with this younger woman playing these love scenes as this butch lesbian, it was daunting and kind of thrilling at the same time, because it felt so unlikely.
So I want to hear what else you had to do to butch up.
Well, let's just say my wife got a kick out of it. I It really was about getting the right kind of boots. I was thin. I had sort of a boyish figure. I had sort of my fantasy sort of butch costume, but I just had to get in touch with my my masculinity, I guess. But I definitely had to develop an easy, confident swagger. That's for sure.
Yeah, I noticed the swagger. Yeah.
Yeah, and that thing that I've been told by heterosexual girlfriends that all men, till their dying day, find themselves incredibly appealing. whereas women, you know, the older we get, the less appealing we feel. So I had to sort of, again, get in touch with that masculinity that allows one to be incredibly confident no matter what, sexually.
So I want to ask you about growing up gay in Tennessee, in Paris, Tennessee, which is a small town. You were basically always out professionally, but you didn't tell your parents until you were 25. How did they handle it?
I had always known because our parents had told Susan and me all of our lives that they would always love us unconditionally, that their love for us was unconditional. So I knew I wasn't going to lose them. But it was, as is often the case, it was much more difficult for my mother. And she suffered with it for years, because of course she wanted me to know what she had known and to grow up and marry a wonderful man and have children and grandchildren. And she was so afraid that I was going to go through such sadness and loneliness. And she was born in the 20s, so to be a lesbian to her meant she was going to lead this sad, lonely, dreadful life of living in a closet and having no intimacy ever in your life. And I finally, one day, we talked, and I said, "Mother, are you still having trouble with all of this?" This was years later. I was in my early 30s at this point. And she said, "Darling, intellectually, I'm okay. It's just emotionally, I'm still a basket case." And my family is religious and has a very strong, very open, enlightened faith. And I said, "Mother, for you to grieve over your healthy, happy, stable child for the rest of your life is a sin."
And how did she take that?
And that actually helped a lot. She started to realize that it was ludicrous to spend all this time grieving over such a relatively well-adjusted, happy child. And then she became the counselor for the parents of other children in our hometown who were grappling with their child being gay. She was an educator. She was an English teacher, and a brilliant, brilliant teacher. So she used that in later life to help a lot of folks in my hometown with their gay children.
So this might be too personal, but I'm going to ask it, and you could tell me you don't want to answer it, okay? Because I don't want to be intrusive. Okay. I think a lot of actresses, a lot of journalists who are on television, a lot of everybody who's in film or television or stage, or politics even, that a lot of women and men too feel pressure to have a cosmetic surgery so that they look younger and so that the lines don't show because, you know, wrinkles are considered like very unflattering and people want to get rid of them. Seeing you, I suspect you have not had cosmetic surgery. And if that's true, I want to say thank you. And it's not because I disapprove of cosmetic surgery. I just don't think it should be required. I don't think that people should feel like they have to do it or else they no longer have a career or they can no longer feel decent about themselves.
Indeed, you were right, Terry. I have not had cosmetic surgery. You know, I'm wrinkly like my father's mother. I like my face. I'll see my friends who've had Botox or whatever, and I think, "Oh man, they look so young. They look so great," and I'm happy for them that there's something that can do that. But it's just never been anything. I guess I just never cared about it. And also, as an actor, they're going to have to be some actors left who can play the old craggy women, you know? And you cannot apply cragginess to a good, lifted, Botoxed face. You cannot. Maybe one day they'll be able to do it in post as they CGI the wrinkles on. But I think I get a lot of jobs, honestly, because I haven't had cosmetic surgery. I mean, it wouldn't be right for Offred's mother in Handmaid's Tale to look too done to, the character in Transparent, or even Nan Pierce in Succession. Those old WASP gals, you know, they let their hair go gray and they don't touch their faces. So, you know, it actually works to my benefit more often than not.
Cherry Jones, thank you so much for coming back to Fresh Air. It's been great to talk with you.
Terry, I'll come back anytime you'll have me.
Cherry Jones is nominated for an Emmy for her performance in the HBO series Succession. Last Tuesday, Turner Classic Movies began presenting an ambitious 14-hour series about female filmmakers looking at their collective work internationally and throughout the history of cinema. Episodes of this series, called Women Make Film, will be shown each Tuesday night through December 1st, accompanied by some of the movies discussed in the series. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Each of the 14 hours of TCM's Women Make Film begins the same way, with actress Tilda Swinton, one of the documentary's narrators and executive producers, describing the journey to come.
Most films have been directed by men. Most of the recognized so-called movie classics were directed by men. But for 13 decades and on all six filmmaking continents, thousands of women have been directing films too. Some of the best films.
Women Make Film, which premiered last year at the Toronto Film Festival, takes us on a trip that's both intellectual and emotional. But as road movies go, this documentary doesn't follow any traditional map. In fact, its approach is so unusual, it arrives with its own disclaimer, with the narrator, Tilda Swinton again, explaining what viewers are not about to see.
What follows is not about the directors' lives. It's not a chronological history. It's not an analysis of how women directors are different from men. And it's not one of those lists of the best films ever made. No, it has cleaner lines than that. Our film is about the films, the scenes. It answers practical questions. What's an engaging way to start a film? How do you set its tone? How do you make it believable?
So what approach does Women Make Film and its writer-director Mark Cousins take? Instead of stepping back and looking at the big picture, and only the big pictures, this documentary zooms in on individual scenes. It pulls almost 1,000 examples from 130 years of film history covering six continents. But it doesn't cover that ground by starting at the beginning or by highlighting the most recognizable or significant names. Elise Guy Blechet, the first woman director and filmmaker of the silent era, doesn't show up until episode 4. Ida Lupino, one of the first female members of the Directors Guild of America, arrives in episode 2. And there aren't a lot of talking heads or interviews. Women Make Film allows the film excerpts to speak for themselves. Except, that is, for the almost constant narration, which points out specifics as each scene unspools. The documentary is subdivided into 40 topics or chapters, starting with the way certain movies open and covering subjects as general as dreams and as specific as editing. The observations are very specific, and we return to certain movies time and again, watching them illustrate various points. It's a unique approach, but it works. And the point here is that it covers the entire history of cinema and provides hundreds of examples of both artistic and technical achievement, while showcasing only the work of female filmmakers from around the globe. Film historians haven't paid as much attention to them as to their male counterparts, but this documentary series does, and goes a long way towards correcting that. And let's talk about that narration. Those duties are divided throughout the documentary by a series of international voices. In the U.S., we're likely to be most familiar with Jane Fonda and Deborah Winger. But it's Tilda Swinton who stands out the most here. She approaches each film like a sportscaster providing play-by-play and delivers her words poetically with a quiet passion that brings to mind the narration of David Attenborough or Werner Herzog. Here she is describing a 1947 movie called The Last Stage as we watch one of its scenes. I'd never seen this movie before, but I really, really want to see it now.
We're back in Poland again. A smile broken by a run. But even across the road isn't safe. So they're back here. And a slight pan right. But then, a German soldier. And pan is left. And left. Still no cut. Then hustled. Hassled. Deported. And then, the dreaded dissolve to the dreaded place. Auschwitz. Astonishingly, writer-director Wanda Jakubowska had been a prisoner in Auschwitz. Now, just 1 year after it was liberated, she's back there as a movie maker, shooting this film, The Last Stage. It's a masterpiece.
Women Make Film doesn't exclude the blockbusters or prominent successes. Wonder Woman by Patty Jenkins is here, as are The Hurt Locker by Kathryn Bigelow and Big by Penny Marshall. But the primary joy of this documentary is seeing one small unfamiliar scene that makes you passionate about seeking out the entire film. I walked away with a long list, including not only The Last Stage, but Blackboards, Evolution, Tomboy, and others. None of those, it turns out, will be shown by TCM during its Tuesday night showcases this fall. But I'll find them anyway. Meanwhile, the movies that are presented alongside Women Make Film include a lot of other great titles, from the well-known The Hurt Locker and The Night Porter to relatively obscure but eminently worthwhile international productions. Those films, like the documentary, will be presented by TCM hosts Alicia Malone and Jacqueline Stewart, whose enthusiasm matches their expertise. I expect they'll be great guides for this cinematic road trip, and I can't wait to start. After all, how else can we safely travel around the world right now?
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and professor of TV studies at Rowan University. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We're used to a world in which American intelligence services operate with enormous power and reach. Our next guest, journalist Scott Anderson, has a new book about the early years of the CIA, when America was victorious in World War II and former soldiers were improvising a campaign of spying and covert operations to contain and undermine the nation's new adversary, the Soviet Union. It was a time, Anderson writes, when Americans wielded great moral authority in the world, and nations struggling to throw off colonial rule looked to the U.S. as a beacon of freedom and democracy. Anderson concludes that the CIA's rigid commitment to anti-communism and its willingness to topple democratically elected governments squandered the goodwill it held in the developing world and led to a disastrous war in Vietnam. Anderson tells the story through the lives of four young men who played important roles in the CIA. Scott Anderson is the author of two novels and four books of nonfiction. In 2016, he authored a story about the modern history of the Middle East, which took up an entire issue of the New York Times Magazine. It was called Fractured Lands: How the Arab World Came Apart. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies about his new book, The Quiet Americans.
Well, Scott Anderson, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
You lived abroad a lot as a kid, including a long time in Taiwan, where you kind of grew up on the edges of the Cold War. You know, you're right that your father, who worked for the U.S. government, eventually became disillusioned with the policy approaches of the government and took an early retirement. You went on to become a journalist. You were a war correspondent in a lot of conflict zones. And you tell a story of a moment in Central America that kind of captured your own reckoning with the U.S. commitment to anti-communism and its effect. Do you want to share that with us?
Sure. It was in 1984. I was an aspiring journalist at that point. I had gone down to El Salvador. And in 1984, the so-called dirty war in El Salvador was really starting to wind down a bit. And perhaps over the previous 4 years, something like 60,000 people had died in this war. And the vast majority of them killed by, not in combat, but by right-wing death squads that were part of the government.
You know, it was a leftist insurgency against a right-wing government, right? Yeah.
That's right. And a right-wing government being supported by the Reagan administration. But by 1984, the Reagan administration's whole attitude was, well, the war is winding down. You know, the death squads are not nearly as active as they once were. And, you know, they're really not part of the government. And so this fiction had been going on for quite some time. And so this one day I was in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador, and I was walking along a downtown street, and a van passed me. It pulled to a stop maybe, I don't know, 100 feet ahead of me. And out came a body of a dead woman. Her thumbs were tied in front of her. And just the body was just tossed out on the street. And as I was the only person on this street, and as I kind of tentatively walked towards this woman who I, you know, clearly knew was dead, even before I got to her, a matter of maybe 10 seconds after the first van had pulled away, a military van pulls up. Three soldiers get out. One points a gun at my feet, kind of the universal, you know, stay back symbol. And the other two men, the other two soldiers, you know, pick up the body, throw it in their van. They all get back in the van and drive away. So it was this very kind of very seamless sleight of hand idea where the so-called anonymous death squad has dumped this body, and literally 10 seconds later, the government has come to collect it. And there was something in that moment that just for me, it just really brought home this idea of, you know, what has the American government come to? That we are supporting governments who will murder their own citizens and just throw their bodies out in broad daylight. And so that was really kind of a turning point for me of just how squalid had our foreign policy become. Hmm.
So this book is about the early years of the CIA, kind of from the end of World War II through the mid-50s, and when the CIA had sort of become a primary instrument of policy in fighting the Cold War. You know, we're used to the American intelligence community being huge, but before World War II, the Soviets had a huge intelligence operation. They'd been spying for a long time. Not so much the United States. Why?
You know, America was really, up until we came into World War II, we were still a deeply isolationist country, I think, at our core, to the point where we had no permanent foreign intelligence agency. It wasn't until World War II, with the creation of the Office of Strategic Services, that there was any kind of foreign intelligence office. And so the four men I profile were all in the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, during the war. And then President Truman shut down the OSS in the immediate aftermath of the war. And it was this idea that, okay, the war is over, we're all going home. The American military was demobilizing at the rate of 15,000 soldiers a day. And it was like, our job is done, and we're going back home to our, you know, our American way of life. So utterly unprepared for what was coming. There was an interim organization that started. It was kind of the bridge between the OSS and the CIA. And one of the men I write about in the book, Peter Sichel, he was sent to Berlin to head up this unit of the Strategic Services Unit. And this really goes to just how kind of utterly unprepared the Americans were. Berlin, of course, being the post-war Berlin, was ground zero of the coming Cold War. And there were hundreds, if not thousands, of Soviet intelligence officers running through Berlin. And the unit that Peter Sichel headed up and was the first covert intelligence unit in Berlin consisted of 9 people. And he was the head of it, and he had just turned 24. So it really just shows how completely, I mean, not to take anything away from Peter, he was a brilliant man, but they really were not preparing for what they were in for.
So as World War II was wrapping up and the Soviet army was moving into a lot of nations in Eastern Europe, the American policymakers at the top didn't quite get the extent to which the Soviet would seek to create client states in Eastern Europe. And these early spies that you write about in the book, these members, most of whom had been soldiers, some in some cases operating clandestinely behind German lines, these guys encountered this and kind of had to alert American policymakers to what's going on. And one of the most striking examples was in the country of Romania. That was Frank Wisner, right, who was there?
That's right, Frank Wisner.
Tell us what he experienced there with the Soviet moves in Romania.
Yeah, Frank Wisner is—he's a fascinating figure, and he would later go on to head the covert operations wing of the CIA, the Office of Policy Coordination. But in 1944, the Romanians, who had been allied with Nazi Germany, switched sides and joined the Allies. And it came when the Soviet Army, the Red Army, was literally on the frontier with Romania. So Romania came under Soviet Army control very quickly. Frank Wisner was the first American in, and this you're talking August, September, I guess September of 1944. So there's still another year left to the war. And what he saw firsthand was how the Soviets were just dictating the interim government. They were frankly looting the country of Romania, dismantling factories and putting them on trains and hauling them back to the Soviet Union. And he started sending these cables saying our allies, the Soviets, are just completely taking over this country. And again, this very early warning, I mean, he was the canary in the coal mine, was just ignored to the point where the head of the OSS, William Donovan, sent him back kind of a stern cable saying, don't keep beating up on the Soviets, you have to get along with them.
The OSS being the precursor to the CIA, right?
That's right. That's right. And, and part of it, and this was just in the run-up to, the Yalta Conference, where the right wing, political right wing of the United States, and even today, sort of sees Yalta as a sellout of Eastern Europe, that FDR handed Eastern Europe over to the Soviets. But what you also saw at the same time, and Romania is a good example of this, is what could the Americans have done? Short of going to war, or threatening war with the Soviet Union, how are they going to exert their control over Eastern Europe? In Romania, by 1945, by the end of the war, there were 600,000 Soviet troops just in Romania. And the Americans' contingent in Romania was about 150. Not 150,000, but 150. So how are 150 guys going to stand up to 600,000? So there really was this element of fait accompli that you saw throughout Eastern Europe, unless the United States was really, really willing to threaten war, which also meant stopping the demobilization and gearing up for what would have been World War III.
Right. There's a context here, and that is that, the Soviets had suffered terribly at the hands of the German invasion, 20 million or more killed, and the Romanians were on the side of the Germans here. So when it came time for the Soviets to come back and take the country, there wasn't much goodwill. I mean, there was a sense of hatred and vengeance to be enacted on these people, their former adversaries who had cooperated with the Nazis. And so that was part of what was going on. But they really took over the government, kind of basically banned all other political parties. And there's another moment which is so striking where there were about 100,000 people in Romania of ethnic German descent. What did the Soviets do with them?
Right, and this is when the war is still raging, but Romania is now behind the front lines. The Soviets sent down this edict that all ethnic Germans were to be rounded up, and some 100,000 of them were put on trains, overcrowded trains, and sent to the Soviet Union, essentially as slave labor. And Frank Wisner was in Bucharest, the capital, when this was going on. He tried to prevent it. He couldn't prevent it. And that image haunted him forever, this watching these tens of thousands of ethnic German families being herded onto rail cars and sent off to the Soviet Union. It's something that came up again and again with Frank Wisner throughout the rest of his life. And his wife at one point said, you know, I think everything changed for him at that moment.
You know, this image of these civilians being hauled into railroad cars and taken away just inevitably calls to mind the Holocaust. Was that comparison apparent to anybody at the time?
I think that's exactly what was in Wisner's mind. And I got to say, the interesting thing is that, in fact, most of those 100,000 ethnic Germans that were sent to the Soviet Union in 1944, the vast majority of them actually came back. They were worked hard labor for the Soviets, but the vast majority of them came home. But I think the reason that was such a had such a profound effect on Wisner as a witness to that was that in his own mind, it inevitably drew comparisons to the Holocaust. So I think that's the image that he kept in his mind.
So eventually, U.S. policymaker realizes that the Soviet Union intends to dominate the countries of Eastern Europe. And, you know, there was an argument that they needed a buffer zone given the suffering that they had suffered in World War II. But it was heavy-handed. It was ruthless. And so they directed this growing little spy operation, the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, which became the CIA, to start doing something about it, to fight back. And you're right about one of the first places was Albania, you know, between Greece and Yugoslavia. What did they try and do to deal with the Soviet client regime there?
Right. So the interesting thing with Albania from a kind of geopolitical standpoint is that of the Soviet bloc countries, it was the one that was had no border with the Soviet Union. It was the most geographically isolated. And especially Yugoslavia, which surrounds it on two sides, had kind of broken away from the Soviet bloc. So Albania was quite isolated and also had a really despotic dictator who ran things. So the CIA decided that, you know, if they were going to be able to peel off any country from the Soviet bloc, it would be Albania. And, you know, this was an idea heartily endorsed by tens of thousands of Albanian refugees who had escaped communist rule there. So they launched this operation called Operation Valuable Fiend. It's a great name. I actually got very lucky with the operational names in my book because, I could have been stuck with really quite tedious ones. But, a Valuable Fiend is just perfect. One of the other characters of my book, Michael Burke, he was put in charge of Operation Valuable Fiend. He operated it out of Rome. So, and there's this kind of wonderful kind of James Bond quality to this, to Michael Burke's time in Rome, where he has no job, but he has a lot of money. He's throwing around a lot of money. So he has to look like a man of means. And so he passes himself off. His cover story is that he's a film producer.
Right. He has a lot of money because he got it from the CIA, right?
That's right. Yeah. And so he's hanging out with the whole film set of Rome. And the late 40s was kind of the heyday of the Italian cinema scene. So during the day, he's hanging out with all these actors and movie directors. And at night, he's slipping off to meet with his Albanian conspirators they're going to be dropping paramilitaries in airdrops into Albania. And this kind of bifurcated life he went to back and forth. And at one point, he became worried that, I'm passing myself off as a film producer here, but I'm not actually producing anything. And at a certain point, aren't people going to start asking questions about, what I'm doing? But it turned out that the Italian film people were just as self-absorbed as people in Hollywood, and so all they wanted to do was talk about themselves. They were never going to ask questions about what he was up to. So his cover remained intact. But the Operation Valuable Fiend turned into a disaster. It was a precursor of a number of disasters that were coming.
So what they would do is they would get these Albanian anti-communist patriots and convince them to be dropped in groups of, 4, 5, 10 behind Albanian lines and do what exactly?
that was the part that was very vague. It was, you know, it ranged everything. Oh, they're supposed to go in just to, you know, is there the potential for counter-revolution here? Maybe they're going to go in to set up revolutionary cells to organize people to fight against this the regime. But the reality was that certainly Albania was one of the most battened-down countries. The secret police were everywhere. And so the moment these people parachuted in, the secret police were already looking for them. Plus the fact that almost certainly the emigre organizations back in Europe, in Western Europe, had been thoroughly infiltrated by the KGB.
So they went badly, and a lot of these people were captured and killed, right? If not all, right?
Right, and Albania was a precursor to other infiltration operations all through Eastern Europe, and uniformly they were a disaster.
Well, it's quite a story. Scott Anderson, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate it being on.
Scott Anderson spoke to Fresh Air's Dave Davies. His new book is called The Quiet Americans, Four CIA Spies at the Dawn of the Cold War, a tragedy in three acts.